From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a look at Al Gore, farm boy, senator's son, enlisted man, and politician. We talk with Melinda Henneberger, Washington correspondent for The New York Times. She's been writing a series of biographical articles on Gore. Also, British actress Brenda Blethyn. She's best known for her roles in Secrets and Lies, for which she was nominated for an Oscar, and Little Voice. Her new film is the British comedy Saving Grace. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The Democratic National Convention opened in Los Angeles today. President Clinton is to speak to the delegates this evening. According to an advance text, the president will assert that the nation is more confident, hopeful, and just than 8 years ago. He'll praise his vice president, Al Gore, as the man to keep progress and prosperity going. Gore, who will accept his party's nomination Thursday night, is slowly making his way west. Today he stopped in Independence, Missouri to promote the expansion of Medicare coverage to include prescription drugs. Matt Hackworth of member station KPUR reports.
A crowd of senior citizens packed into a community center here at the invitation of Vice President Al Gore for a town hall-style forum on prescription drug care. Gore chose Independence because the bill that gave birth to Medicare was signed into law here 35 years ago. Now the vice president wants to expand Medicare coverage to include prescription drugs.
Joe Lieberman and I are for prescription drug benefits under the Medicare program for all of our senior citizens. It is time to give them that help because they're having trouble paying their bills.
After a stop in Michigan tomorrow, Gore heads to the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles. For NPR News, I'm Matt Hackworth in Independence, Missouri.
A California congresswoman who clashed with party leaders over a proposed fundraiser at the Playboy Mansion will not be speaking at the convention after all. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
Loretta Sanchez is a co-chair of the Democratic National Committee, and she was scheduled to speak tomorrow night. But a spokesman for the DNC says Sanchez notified the committee earlier today that she no longer wished to speak. Last week, Sanchez resisted pressure to move a fundraiser she had planned to hold at the Playboy Mansion. But after Democrats removed her from her speaking slot, she gave in, shifting the event to B.B. King's Blues Club. Her position was subsequently restored. Party leaders, including Vice President Al Gore, worried that using the Playboy Mansion would give Republicans a campaign issue and send the wrong message as Democrats try to leave the sex and money scandals of the Clinton administration behind. The vice president has accepted campaign money from Playboy, including a $1,000 donation Hugh Hefner made last year. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The Russian Navy is trying to find a way to rescue more than 100 sailors trapped in a nuclear sub since yesterday. The crippled sub is at the bottom of the Barents Sea inside the Arctic Circle after being involved in an accident during a training exercise. The Kursk is one of Russia's largest nuclear submarines. Officials say it was not carrying nuclear weapons. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 148 points to finish at 11,176, its highest close since early April. The Nasdaq rose 60 points, while the S&P 500 climbed more than 19. This is NPR News. Energy Secretary Bill Richardson is reportedly urging the Justice Department to wrap up its investigation at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. NPR's Barbara Bradley has more.
The FBI has been investigating the possibility of a cover-up concerning the temporary disappearance of critical nuclear information. Several weeks ago, the Department of Energy announced that two hard drives containing information about how to dismantle nuclear devices went missing. The hard drives later showed up behind a copy machine in a secure vault at Los Alamos. Sources say the FBI suspects that the scientists are remaining silent to protect each other. Quote, "They saw what happened to Wen-Ho Lee," says one source, referring to the former nuclear scientist who is now in jail awaiting trial for mishandling information. Now the FBI is running into criticism. An email circulating the lab claims that the first FBI agent to find the hard drives physically handled them. The FBI says none of the evidence was compromised. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
The worst wildfire season in 50 years has coaxed many former rangers and foresters out of retirement. Hundreds of retirees have decided to join the effort to put out dozens of wildfires raging across the West. Right now, there are about 82 significant fires burning in 13 states and not enough firefighters to do the job. Officials say most of the retirees now on duty are working in support roles, such as transporting supplies, running base camps, and ferrying firefighters to and from the fire lines. 53-year-old Joe Colwell, a retired ranger from Hotchkiss, Colorado, said it's either this or canning peaches at home. I'm Noor Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. One of the acknowledged goals of this week's Democratic National Convention is to distance Vice President Al Gore from the moral lapses of the Clinton era and convince the electorate that Gore is his own man. Melinda Henneberger, the Washington correspondent for The New York Times, has been writing a series of biographical pieces on Al Gore. Her husband, Bill Turk, is the author of the biography Inventing Al Gore. We invited Henneberger to talk about the profiles that have already been published, which covered Gore's life up until his victory in his first race for Congress in Tennessee. Henneberger describes Gore's childhood as divided between the family farm in Carthage, Tennessee, where the Gores spent summers and holidays, and Washington, D.C., where Senator Albert Gore Sr. and his family lived in a hotel owned by relatives. While Republican critics have painted Vice President Gore's Tennessee years as photo op interludes to a childhood of privilege in Washington, Henneberger writes that Al Gore did form close ties with people in Carthage and, at his father's insistence, put in some hard time on the farm.
It was very important for Senator Gore to believe that he was giving his son a proper work ethic. And I know some of the folks I talked to in Tennessee who used to work alongside him on the farm were appalled at how hard he had to work, and they felt that he was constantly being driven to set the standard and to work harder than anyone who had been hired to work there. His high school girlfriend told me a story that has really stayed with me about one summer. Each summer, the senator would think of a special project for his son to accomplish during the summer. And one summer it was to cut, I think it was 20 acres and 20 very hilly acres with a hand axe. And this is a job that, from what his friend said, not only did not necessarily need doing, but could have been accomplished in several hours with a bulldozer. But so he's out there all summer long with the hand axe, and his girlfriend comes along one day and finds that he has cut into a hornet's nest and been bitten all over. And I remember her saying pretty bitterly, you know, but that didn't matter. He had to keep right on working. So I think when we see Al Gore today as such a hard worker and someone who in some ways seems happiest when he's working hardest and contributing, I think a lot of it does come from those experiences.
Now, I think people have gotten the impression that in contrast to his life in Tennessee, his life in Washington was very privileged. He attended St. Albans Prep School.
Mm-hmm.
But you write that his family lived in a hotel because they couldn't even afford a house in Washington.
I looked through some of the senator's correspondence from that period, and they were constantly looking for a real house and didn't get one because nothing was in their price range. And he certainly was privileged in certain ways. I mean, in the powerful people that his parents spent time with and had over to the apartment. But I think materially, most people would be surprised to hear that he wore his cousin's hand-me-downs and shared a bedroom with his sister, who was 10 years older. His entire childhood, except for the year she was in college. She lived there, sharing the room both before and after her college years.
Much has been made of just how apolitical George W. Bush was during his college years at Yale, how he was a frat boy in the midst of the political protests over the Vietnam War. Al Gore was at Harvard in the late 60s. What were the young Gore's politics in college?
It's funny, he actually was a lot more moderate. I think he was called a raging moderate even in those days, than any of his friends, and did not get involved in any of the student movements. He sympathized with them, but really felt that they were a little juvenile and beside the point, and really pretty much stayed away from any of the protest groups, though he certainly did oppose the war.
Immediately after he graduated from Harvard, though, he enlisted in the Army.
Right.
Even though he was against the war, as
right.
was his father. His father was up for re-election that year. Just how much did his father's campaign figure in his decision to enlist, in your opinion?
I personally don't believe that his father's race determined the decision. I think certainly it was a factor. There's really no question that had he not gone to Vietnam, he would have been handing his father's political opponents an issue, because Senator Gore's anti-war position was really wildly unpopular in the volunteer state. But I think for him, his friend said over and over, and it fits with him so well, that he just couldn't get past thinking of the kids he'd grown up with spending summers in Tennessee and thinking that he was registered for the draft in Carthage, Tennessee, a small place, and would, if he, as he said, found some fancy way out of going, someone he knew would have to go in his place. Even though he agonized over the decision for a year, I don't think he ever would have made that decision to let someone go in his place, thing, and he would have thought about it that way.
I thought it was interesting that people think of him as this dull, cautious guy, but you said that he felt about his service that it was an exhilarating time.
I think he loved the Army in some ways. I don't think he loved what we were doing in Vietnam, certainly. But, you know, when I asked him about it, he talked about the vividness of it. And I think it really awakened something in him. I think he's quite drawn to vividness. And really, when he came home, had a lot of feelings about wanting to go back and feeling that he hadn't finished what he went there to do, and feeling incomplete because U.S. troops weren't allowed to try to win the war. So I think he had a lot of mixed feelings about it, but I also think it was a time that he was able to feel things quite deeply in a way that has been difficult for him at some times.
After he enlisted, he returned to college in his uniform, and
right.
you write that he was booed and jeered by students in Harvard Yard, and that he was actually surprised by that. And now you
right.
saw that as emblematic of who he is and how he does things. What does it symbolize for you?
Two things. One, I thought he was more surprised than he should have been. Yeah, and at Harvard in 1969, I don't think anybody should have been surprised to have been booed if they showed up in an Army uniform. I mean, those were the days when they were yelling baby killers at people in uniform. But you see that in him now, too. Sometimes he is a little more surprised by reactions than he ought to be. But I also think there's a defiance in it that we don't always associate with him, that it was kind of a one-man demonstration to sort of, you know, put it in these kids' faces that maybe these decisions about the war were not as simple as they thought.
Did Al Gore have much fun in college?
You know, the answer to almost every question about Al Gore is yes and no. I think that, as his friend Tommy Lee Jones said, you know, being 21 is fun if you have any brains at all, even with Vietnam hanging over them. I think that it was a much more serious time on campus than it had been a few years earlier, obviously. I mean, when he went to Harvard, wanted to go to Jack Kennedy's Harvard. And when he first got there, it was still a place where you dressed for dinner and where parietals were in effect, where you couldn't, you know, have girls in the boys' rooms beyond a certain hour. And by his senior year, some students had taken over the main administration building and were clubbed by police who kicked them out. So it was a pretty heavy time, and he was really concerned about whether or not he should go to Vietnam, and that's not a light decision. There was a lot going on that I think made it a serious time. Yet, on the other hand, he does seem to have had a great time. He and Tipper decided to get married while he was there. He formed a lot of friendships with folks he's still close to today. So, as everything with Al Gore, it's a complicated picture.
Melinda Henneberger is my guest. She's a Washington correspondent for the New York Times. She's covering the campaign for the paper, and she's been writing a series of biographical pieces on Vice President Al Gore. We'll talk more, Melinda, after the break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with New York Times political reporter Melinda Henneberger. She's been covering the presidential campaign and writing a series of biographical pieces on candidate Al Gore. Part of Al Gore's motivation in enlisting, you write, was to help his father overcome an unpopular stance against the war to win election in 1970. And despite Al Gore appearing in uniform behind his father at rallies, the senator did lose the campaign. And as you point out, it was a campaign that became a model of dirty politics. It came out in the Watergate hearings that illegal money from Nixon operatives poured into the coffers of Gore Sr.'s opponent, Bill Brock.
Right.
What lesson did Al Gore carry away from his father's defeat?
I think a couple of lessons. I think one was about fundraising. I think that I asked him how much his father's experience of getting outspent and outmaneuvered by people who weren't playing fair had made him into a pretty enthusiastic fundraiser. And he said, yeah. He said, you know, I'm representing the little guy. He's depending on me. He was really quite adamant. They're depending on me, and the rich will always have the advantage. They will always have more money. But if I can even the score, if I can make it a little easier, if there's anything I can do to represent those people better, you bet. So I think that a lot of his zeal for fundraising goes back to his father's experience. One of the other reasons Senator Gore lost that race was that he was perceived to have gotten out of touch with his constituents, and that he just wasn't working hard to stay in touch with them, was spending more time at Georgetown dinner parties chasing after the Kennedys than he was attending to the needs of Tennesseans. And Gore certainly learned that lesson. From the moment he first announced he was running for Congress, has been incredibly hardworking. He had something like 1,200 town hall meetings back in Tennessee when he was in Congress. Today, when you see him on the stump, keeps a much, much more grueling pace than his opponent.
You write that his first campaign showed Al Gore at his best and worst as a candidate. How so?
Well, at his best, the hard worker that he was then and still is now, you know, these town hall meetings. I was at one in California a few months ago, and he, I think it was close to 1 a.m. I mean, everyone was just, how long can this possibly go on? He will stay and answer every question. And until you can sense that the people in the audience are only staying because they think it might be rude to leave him there alone. So very hardworking. Also very knowledgeable, you know, having his facts down cold. But in that race, even some of his friends were a little turned off to his willingness to shift positions, particularly on gun control, to appear more conservative in a very conservative district in which he wouldn't have gotten elected had he not presented himself as a moderate.
Did he present himself as a moderate in part to distinguish himself from his father, who was perceived at least in
Tennessee? Sure, absolutely. He really, part of distancing himself from his father in that race was to show that he was not the liberal his father is. And some of that is quite valid. I mean, so, for example, on national defense and on law enforcement and justice issues, he has been consistently conservative. On other matters, he certainly moved for the race, gun control, possibly abortion. It's less clear what he really thought about abortion rights before that time, but he certainly has moved since then. He called homosexuality abnormal in that race, a position he obviously no longer holds, but
now, according to one report, at least, Gore is writing his own speech for the convention.
Right.
And it's somewhat of a concern, and there's a lot of speculation whether the vice president relies too much on his own counsel and the counsel of his immediate family, Tipper Gore and Corinna Gore Schiff, his daughter. In your most recent piece to run in the paper about Gore's first campaign, you seem to agree with this, that this has been a pattern throughout his political career.
Oh, sure. His aides will say that he's much more inclined to listen to his family than he is to any of them. And, you know, sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. The most obvious example of the latter is when there was the question about his having made fundraising calls from the White House. And he was completely convinced that he had done nothing wrong, and that if he immediately gave a press conference telling us that he had done nothing wrong, we Americans would see that he was right. And so he got up there and gave the famous no controlling legal authority, which all his family and none of his aides apparently thought was a fine idea.
Well, in writing the series, then, did you come away with a clear idea of his core beliefs, his value system, his sense of himself, and how consistent he has been on the issues over time?
I think he has been consistent on some issues, obviously, and not so consistent on others, particularly those two, again, abortion and gun control. I think on abortion, I think he has, as he says, evolved over the years. I think his wife and daughters have helped change his views on those things. I think the problem with him and the reason he sometimes is hard to place and that we sometimes say, you know, we don't know where he stands, is that his views are often pretty complicated and sometimes even contradictory. For example, I think that free trade is something he cares about a lot, and helping working people and supporting the unions is something he also cares about a lot, and that's not always easy to work out. So, I think, for example, I think that a lot of times when we listen to him and when we say, you know, he's hedging, he doesn't want to show where he stands on this issue, he's really, ironically, trying to tell us everything he thinks about the issue. If you ask him just about any question, he'll start by saying, well, on one level, and then he'll march you through many, many more levels. And he's really trying, I think in a lot of cases, to be so complete and to sort of download the whole file and to be completely forthcoming. But sometimes the more he talks, the more it sounds like he's hedging, even when he's not.
So far, your series has just brought Al Gore up to midlife. Could you tell us what the next installment holds?
The next installment is about the time when he was writing Earth in the Balance after his failed 88 presidential campaign, and particularly after his son was injured quite seriously in a car accident. He really did a lot of thinking about what was important in his life, and I think felt quite guilty about not having spent more time both with his family and on projects that he felt mattered. I know he felt particularly that he should have talked more about the environment in his 1988 race, whether people really wanted to hear it or not, and they didn't. So he decided he was going to do something that really meant something. And what he did was write a book that was really incredibly bold. I mean, you don't see a lot of sitting senators with big aspirations writing a book that's not just controversial and personal, but really guaranteed to attract a lot of ridicule. And then he vowed an end to finger-in-the-wind politics, and when he was barely back from his book tour, he hooked up with Bill Clinton and took a job that doesn't allow anybody in it, the vice presidency, to be independent. So, interesting.
Melinda Henneberger, I want to thank you very much for talking with us on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Melinda Henneberger is the Washington correspondent for The New York Times. She's writing a series of articles on the life of Al Gore. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, portraying British working-class single moms, we meet actress Brenda Blethyn. Her films include Secrets and Lies and Little Voice. In her new film, Saving Grace, she's a respectable widow left with a mountain of debt who starts growing marijuana in her greenhouse. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Brenda Blethyn is a British stage actress best known to audiences here in the States for her portrayals of single mothers, both in Mike Leigh's Secrets and Lies, which won her an Oscar nomination, and the film Little Voice with Michael Caine. In her new film, Saving Grace, Blethyn cuts loose from the mother stereotype. She plays Grace, a recent widow whose philandering husband leaves her monstrously in debt. Grace enters into a desperate scheme with her gardener, Matthew, played by Craig Ferguson, to raise money by growing marijuana. One critic describes Saving Grace as trying to do for marijuana dealing what the Full Monty did for male striptease, a BBC sitcom as imagined by Cheech and Chong. In this scene from Saving Grace, Matthew is showing Grace for the first time the plants he's been growing undercover in a church graveyard.
Why are you whispering?
I don't want any wake up any squirrels or anything. Just stay here.
Here. Are these Gerald's plants?
No, they're mine. I think I might have overwatered them.
I'm not stupid, Matthew. I know what this is.
What is it?
Hemp.
Is it? Right, it's hemp.
Well, they're not getting enough light, are they? They're never going to grow in the dark down here.
Well, I didn't really want anybody to see them.
Well, you wouldn't, would you?
No.
Well, if you want these poor things to grow, they need some decent soil and some better light.
Okay, thanks.
Come on, then. Let's take one back to the greenhouse, see what we can do.
Well, you may not want to do that.
I'm a gardener. These are sick plants.
Brenda Blethyn, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Grace is a masterful gardener of all kinds of plants, and she ends up then growing these hundreds of kilos of marijuana, enough to fill a whole greenhouse. I understand you used actual hemp plants. Did that cause any problems with the law, or did you have to get a special dispensation to work with hemp?
Oh, yes, we did. Now, the marijuana plants, most of them, I hasten to add, are made by our expert design department, Eve Stewart, who you might know was Oscar nominated for Topsy Turvy. But the ones in the foreground are actual hemp plants, and they were loaned to us under special dispensation from the Home Office, from the government, and they arrived under police escort and I think were locked up at night. However, the potent part of their plant had been removed. So it's rather like taking the caffeine out of coffee or the alcohol out of beer. But I don't know what they did with the bit they took out. I've no idea where that
it disappeared mysteriously.
Where that went to. But I wouldn't know the difference from one from the other, but that's what I'm told anyway.
There's another great scene in the movie where you're posing as a drug dealer in London, and you're this wonderful upper middle class woman from this small town. You're wearing this brilliant white suit, this lovely get-up with an aviator scarf or something, and you're in the seedy neighborhood in London. Apparently,
yes,
you convinced passerbys rather too well while you were filming the scene.
Yes, I did. Oh, and by the way, she looked fabulous in that suit 25 years ago. It was part of her trousseau. It's a good job she hung on to it, but my goodness, I thought she looked like Dame Edna Everidge. I don't know if you've ever heard of
Absolutely.
Her.
Absolutely.
But yes, it was an improvised scene in a busy, normal shopping day in Portobello Road, and the cameras were hidden. And there was no way it could be choreographed. And so to facilitate that, I was introduced to 40 extras who I'd never seen before in my life before we started the scene. And they were all brilliantly dressed to blend in with normal everyday shoppers. Now, I don't know about you, Barbara, but if you were introduced to 40 strangers who then mingled in with hundreds of other strangers, would you remember which one was which? Because I couldn't.
I don't blame you.
And so inadvertently, I would go up to innocent shoppers and ask if they would like to buy my stash. and then I'd see Nigel waving his hand, shouting, no, not that one. And I have to say, I scored twice. And
And one gentleman tried to make a citizen's arrest on me and put me in an arm lock. And Nigel had to come flying down again from his perch and say, no, 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 please put her down. It's Brenda Blethyn. She's in our film, Saving Grace. You'll love it when you see it. But he did laugh. He did see the funny side of it, the man did. But good for him.
Things could have gotten very ugly.
And somebody was overheard in a shop saying, have you seen Brenda Blethyn out on the street there? She's selling drugs. Must have thought I'd hit on hard times.
My guest is actress Brenda Blethyn. Her new film is Saving Grace. You were nominated for an Oscar for your role as Cynthia in Mike Leigh's Secrets and Lies. Cynthia is a bit of a down-and-out working-class single mom who, in the course of the film, is reunited with a daughter she gave up for adoption when she was 15. Had you played many working-class women of Cynthia's sort when you were cast in the film?
I've certainly been offered a lot of working-class roles since playing Cynthia. Mostly at the theatre, I would play middle-class characters. But yes, I have played working-class before. Six of one, half a dozen of the other, really. Since I made Secrets and Lies, most of the scripts I received, film scripts, were for unfortunate women who cried a lot. But I didn't
think I could top
that.
She does do a lot of that in the film.
Yes, she is such a sad lady. Mm.
Mike Leigh is well known for his ensemble style of producing a film. He casts actors he wants, and then you all develop the character through months and months of workshops. What did you know about your character, Cynthia, when you arrived for rehearsals the first day of Secrets and Lies?
I knew absolutely nothing about her. She didn't exist when I arrived. I invented her with Mike Leigh. In fact, when you embark on an engagement with Mike Leigh, you have absolutely no idea what sort of role you're going to be playing at all. I could have been playing a duchess for all I knew. Neither are we given a storyline. We know absolutely nothing. And that's not just at the beginning, that's throughout the engagement. I have to say, I didn't know fully what the film was about until I went to see it in the cinema. An actor's only responsibility is to the character they are creating and to any other character they might come into contact with. Obviously, I had seen a cast list. I didn't know everybody on the cast list, so I didn't get to meet a lot of them. And so when Cynthia goes to meet the daughter she gave up for adoption 27 years earlier, I had absolutely no idea whatsoever who was going to turn up, if anybody. It was a total shock.
Now, before I want to talk about that scene where you meet your daughter, but before we do, I'm curious how you begin at the beginning to develop the character. Do you start in chronological order and start with the young backstory of a character named Cynthia?
Yeah, there is no backstory, but you are right. The character is created totally chronologically. And having found a starting point, and that could be anything at all, just one particular characteristic, her generosity, for instance. I don't think it was that, but that could be something. And then you start from the year dot. And then when you get to age four, after maybe 6 weeks or so, of working with Mike Leigh, sort of discovering what this woman, you would build her history in the minutest of detail. For instance, what was the wallpaper like in her bedroom? What was the view from the window? What sounds would be coming from the kitchen? Who else would be in the house at that time of day? And this is from like age four. Would father have gone to work yet? What was the bed linen like? And all these things, so that when you progress, it's totally chronologically, the character is bringing a history with her. So eventually, when the actor is required to go into an improvisation, she has a whole history, rather like now. If we had to start this interview all over again, if this was a film, we'd kind of know what happened. If we had to recreate it, we kind of know how it's come together. But we're not thinking ahead. We just know what's happened to this very moment. So you don't have to invent anything, just react and act as those characters would in any given situation.
I think I read somewhere that you went to the library at one point and looked up the job listings in the paper in the year that Cynthia would have gotten out of school, right?
That's right. She left school in 1966, and I went to the newspaper archive in North London and looked up the actual local paper, the actual week that she left school to see actually what jobs would have been available to her. And I have to say, there were many. Unlike today, when there's lots of unemployment, there were loads and loads of jobs available.
Let's play the scene from Secrets and Lies in which Cynthia meets her daughter Hortense for the first time. And this is her daughter who she gave away at birth and never even held her, didn't ever see her.
That's right, didn't see her.
They agree to talk in a tea room, coffee house. Cynthia doesn't believe Hortense is her daughter because Hortense is black.
They shouldn't go raising your hopes like that. It ain't fair.
Is this your signature?
This is stupid. I don't understand it. I mean, I can't be your mother, can I?
Why not?
Well, look at me.
Well,
listen, I don't mean nothing by it, darling, but I ain't never been with a black man in my life. No disrespect nor nothing. I'd have remembered, wouldn't I?
That's a scene from Secrets and Lies, which starred my guest, Brenda Blethyn. So, and of course, in that pause in the clip, that's really your face doing the acting when you're suddenly remembering, I suppose, a one-night stand.
That's right. Yes. So that's what I mean, in that long pause when she's working it out. Because for 27 years, she thought the father was somebody else, a white man who she'd been working with all that time earlier. And so in that pause, she's working out what could have happened in that time. Who possibly could it have been? And then she remembers an incident in that pause that tells her that probably she is her daughter. But it was just the shock of it. But I have to channel all that through Cynthia's memory, not my own. Brenda thinks that'll probably get a laugh. You know, but that third eye up there watching what I'm doing, because it's not method acting, it's the opposite. You have to be totally objective about what we're doing all the time.
How then does Lee's technique stretch you as an actor or change you as an actor?
Oh, well, I have to say, I worked with Mike Lee, first of all, on a film for the BBC called Grown Ups in 1980. And after working with him on that, I realised that everything I had done beforehand, I'd been really lazy on. And so I on everything I do now, on every scripted piece, well, I mean, mostly I do work on scripted work, I employ some of his technique. I have to work out a back history for the character. If the writer's around, I will consult with him. Or if he's not, I will. I have to know how the character arrives at page one. Where have they been until page one? For instance, in Saving Grace, I open up at page one and here she is in her mid-40s. So I read the script, I know what the script is, but how did she arrive at page one? What mood is she in at the top of page one? Did she have a good night's sleep? And I want to know where she's been for 45 years. And so it's important for me to work that out. I might not share it with anybody, but I need to know it for myself, to know what makes the woman tick.
Which do you prefer, working with a script or without a script?
Oh, I have to say, on occasions during Secrets and Lies, I thought, oh, please, somebody, anybody, give me a script, please. but having some, I'm being flippant, really, because it is such a rewarding process. And at the end of it, you have such a wonderful sense of achievement. You know, you get to use your brain. So every word that comes out of the actor's mouth is invented by the actor. That's not to say it's not Mike Lee's project, because in the end he says what he wants in, what he wants out. He is totally in the driving seat.
and it couldn't possibly happen without him. Because he's, I suppose you could say, totally in charge of the circumstances in which the characters find themselves. And he's ahead of the game. He kind of knows what's going to happen. We don't, because we don't know all the ingredients. He does.
Brenda Blethyn is my guest. She's a longtime British stage actress. She's known to American audiences for her roles in the films Secrets and Lies, Little Voice, and her new movie is Saving Grace. Brenda, let's take a break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Okay.
My guest is actress Brenda Blethyn. She's known for her roles in such films as Secrets and Lies, Little Voice, and her new film is Saving Grace. You played another working-class single mom in Little Voice with Jane Horrocks.
Yes.
This time it's more of the gin-swilling tardy variety, Mari. Let's give people a taste of her. Here she is remembering her good times with Ray Say, a sleazy nightclub talent agent who wants to exploit Mari's daughter's singing talent. In this scene, she's talking to her friend Sadie in a tea room.
Sadie, what a night I had me last night, eh? What a friggin' championship night. You should have seen me. Queen for a night I was. You'll never guess who. Ray Say.
Ray friggin' Say, you know him. He's agent to the stars, king of cabaret, manager of miracles. He's down at Mr. Boo's nightclub all the time. Has that slight look of Elvis about him. You know him, everyone knows him. And he knows everyone. Ain't it when Mr. Boo himself introduced us the other night? And 2 seconds said it, I fib you not. 2 seconds. And his hands on me ass, my golden old ass in Ray Say's hands. While he stands there telling jokes to Mr. Boo. Well, I saw him again last night. Oh, the music was in our heads and in his wandering hands. He'll make it in anything, Ray Say. It's one of them lovable sort of types. Driving me round in his lovable mobile. He motored me round about 1,000,000 miles an hour. Me heart in me mouth, his hand up me skirt and me mind on his meat and veg.
That must have been such great fun. Is that character a staple of British comedy, this blousy, aging party girl? Give us your lips, you, and double me palpitations.
Give us your lips, you.
She's a staple of British life. I don't know. particularly in the north of England, they're very colourful characters in the north, and they're much more social beings. I love being in the north of England. They're really nice people, much more friendly. And in fact, I was watching a documentary the other night on the television, and it was full of people like Mari. I think it's from Bradford or somewhere like that up north. Yes, people like her do exist. I have to say, if I saw her coming towards me down the street, I'd have to cross the road and she would frighten me. She's, yeah, but it was fun to play her, I must say, and it was fabulous working with Michael Caine and Jane Horrocks.
You wear some hideous outfits in this movie, I have to say.
All my own. Not really, I'm joking.
Is it tough to appear on screen in these tight, awful, knit clashing colors, slutty type things?
Yeah, Barbara, I'm often asked that. How do I feel when I see myself looking so awful? And my answer is, I don't see myself. I'm sitting here in the studio in London in an Armani suit. And,
bless your soul.
I see her. I see Cynthia. I'm not playing me. I'm playing somebody else. And it's her problems I sympathize with. I think, oh, God, if you're your own worst enemy, Mari. Don't wear those things. They look dreadful. Don't pull that belt in so tight. You'd probably look better if you didn't. Let the hem down, won't you? And leave those awful pantyhose alone. Yeah, I think the same as other people do watching it. Because I don't see me at all. I see her, that sad, unfortunate, desperate person.
Michael Caine plays Ray in Little Voice.
Yeah.
He's also Mari's love interest. I think Michael Caine is just a wonderful actor, just the true professional. Had you ever worked with him before?
No, I hadn't worked with Michael Caine, and I have to say I was a little apprehensive when I turned up there to work with him because he's so fabulous. I've grown up thinking what a wonderful actor he is, and here I am going to be playing these raunchy scenes with him. And I thought he might pull rank and want the focus of attention on him, and I would feel compromised. But not in the least. He was only concerned, as I was, with the scene working and not in pulling focus. If the scene works, it all works, and not with wanting the focus of attention on him at all. And we had the greatest respect for each other, and it was very, very enjoyable.
I think the first scene you filmed with Michael Caine, you had to leap on him and smother him with kisses.
Yes. Yes, it's the one when she runs out of the house and she leaps on him and kisses him. And yes, I think Mark Herman did that deliberately to sort of cut the ice a little for the more raunchiest scenes later on.
Apparently,
we laughed a lot about it.
You kept messing up. You had to do it over and over and over.
Deliberately. Great.
Brenda Blethyn, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
It's totally my pleasure, Barbara. Thank you.
Brenda Blethyn's new film is Saving Grace. Coming up, a review of two new CDs by singer Juliana Hatfield. This is Fresh Air. A little more than a decade ago, Juliana Hatfield was a singer and bassist in the well-respected Boston cult band Blake Babies. When the band broke up, Hatfield went solo, with only moderate commercial or critical success. Now Hatfield has made the unusual move of releasing two CDs separately and simultaneously. One's called Beautiful Creature, the other is called Total System Failure. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews both discs.
Stuck on a plane, on a runway, cheap red eye, it's a one way, getting back to
two albums, 13 songs each, released simultaneously. Beautiful Creature is intended to be, well, beautiful, tuneful, thoughtful, often acoustic. Total System Failure is, by enormous contrast, a furious freakout, full of feedback. Yet there are ways in which these discs' themes overlap. They're about the choices we make, or the choices we reject, in who has leverage or power in a relationship.
Sky oblivion.
On Beautiful Creatures song Choose Drugs, a guy chooses drugs over Juliana, and on other songs here, she's bullied, confused, and generally down on herself. On Total System Failure, it's a different story. She calls the no-good junkie her slave and commands him to go get her some junk food, some aspirin, cough medicine, and condoms. She equates herself with the drugs he's consuming, all kick, with murderous withdrawal symptoms. Total's tunes about road rage, S&M, one with the refrain, let's get married and rot away, and another one about how much she hates people who have children, are so straight from the heart. This is, after all, confessional songwriting at its most bald. You just know Hatfield must be an awful person to be around sometimes. Scary. Hatfield recorded Beautiful Creatures in Los Angeles, where the sunny skies and mellow vibe temporarily smoothed out her music. But then she got bored, or the city began to get to her, or she just decided that Beautiful Creature was the last thing her career needed at this moment. So she gathered a different bunch of backup musicians, dubbed the new band Julia's Pony, and flogged that horse until it produced Total System Failure. Combine the two discs, and you get a contradictory portrait of Juliana Hatfield. Victim, victimizer, sensitive soul, selfish creep, contemptuous and worthy of contempt. Man, am I glad I only have to experience her through the distance of a CD player.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Megan Howell. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Never needed them. You never needed anyone. The life of the party must decline your invitation to dine. And I'm sorry that I must go so soon. Please forgive me for finding something.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with Emmy Lou Harris. Known as a consummate interpreter of other musicians' songs, she wrote all but one of the selections on her new CD, Red Dirt Girl. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.